Hello, this is Dr. Ryan McConnell, your host with Spilling the DPT, and we'll be using a solo flying interview style episodes for physical therapy students at any level of professional education to engage on hot topics that you wish you had learned in academia. Weekly episodes will include practical survival guides as well as venting on issues surrounding professionalism all the way through healthcare management and leadership. All this delivered with some comedic relief and storytelling to remind you all that we are human. And this is your one-stop shop to receive doses of encouragement and motivation through interview format to improve your PT clout. We are here today with Dr. Josh Subialka, and he's here to discuss some of the differences with clinical training, specifically residency and fellowship. And then pretty much anything that we want to spill the DPT about as it relates to how corporations may view that and other therapists that are graduating or considering it post-graduation within their clinical training. So Josh, if you don't mind, just share with the audience what you're training and kind of all the little hats that you wear from time to time.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Ryan. So I am an assistant clinical professor at Midwestern University in Glendale, Arizona. Started that appointment about two to three months ago. My background that kind of led me to that was graduating from a DPT program in the upper north of Minnesota at the College of St. Scholastica. Got my DPT there in 2014 and moved down to the lovely state of North Carolina, where I spent 6 years with Benchmark Rehab Partners and with Benchmark / now Upstream Rehab Institute. When I was a new grad, I knew that I wanted to do something because I didn't feel fully comfortable. I didn't have a lot of great ortho experiences throughout my clinical rotations in school. And so I knew that I really wanted to hone those skills and get more comfortable with not only the psychomotor aspect of those skills, but also the clinical reasoning behind the evaluation process, the application of skills, and just managing patients. And so in the beginning of 2015, I started with Upstream Rehab Institute, or URI's orthopedic residency program, which was an 18-month program. Did that and then sat for my OCS, passed that. And then once I finished residency, I was still at the point where I knew that I was substantially better off than where I started, but I knew that there was still a long way for me to go. And there were so many things that I realized that I didn't know about. And I saw this behavior modeled from the people who are leading these courses, who are, you know, going through fellowship or who are already fellows. And I knew that that was going to be my next venture. And so as soon as I finished residency and I had about 9 months of studying before my OCS exam, and then 2 months after that started fellowship training, which was another 18-month journey, which was absolutely wild, and did my same thing through URI. And did some mentoring, or almost all of my mentoring up in Virginia at an independent physical therapy clinic with my mentor up there, Ron Mosery. And then from there, you know, it was again one of those things where you just start to realize that you just don't know. Even as I became significantly more comfortable and loved the process of going through fellowship, as uncomfortable as it made me at times, but I knew that there was still more. And so now I'm also enrolled in Bellin's Doctor of Science and Physical Therapy program with you, sir, and a bunch of our other URI faculty and a whole host of other people who have graduated through fellowship programs as kind of a transition, transferring in fellowship credits towards that academic doctoral degree. And in those 6 years since I moved down to North Carolina, and have since now in the last couple months moved out to Arizona, was in the clinic pretty much full time until about the last year or so, where I also started to teach as an adjunct faculty at High Point University. Have spent the last 2 to 3 years really mentoring new graduates, orthopedic residents, and manual therapy fellows in training, which is actually where I'm at right now in Columbus, Ohio. But That's a bit about my background and kind of where I'm at the moment.
So essentially zero credibility. So
no
just
credibility
so everybody
pretty useless if you want to pay, if you want to, you know, not pay attention to a guy, I'm the guy to not pay attention to, really.
That's exactly what I was thinking there. No, we appreciate that you've been through so much to and have so much to offer just anybody who's tuning in. That being said, I think you'll agree that the training is something that a lot of people come out or during entry-level programs thinking that that's something that they want to do. And there's definitely two sides of the coin with residency training and fellowship training. We'll get into that, but where I wanted to start was kind of see what your opinion was for the new graduates that are asking the question, why not self-study? And obviously your background's orthopedics, so we'll stick to that niche. But if they said, Josh, I'm considering the possibility of doing orthopedic residency, but so many people have told me, why not just self-study the OCS and, you know, go through some of the MedBridge study or some of these other programs that are out there. Why not? It's cheaper.
That's a great question. And then the reality is that it is cheaper. And I think it's all dependent on who you are as a learner in large part. You know, what your financial position is certainly a variable that it needs to be considered for me. And I know for a lot of other folks, the big thing was really to have a guided program and to have that clinical mentoring. And I think, you know, as with all the people that I've mentored through their orthopedic residency over the years, the feedback that I consistently get anecdotally is that mentoring was by far the most valuable component of that. And not to say that you can't learn a lot through the self-study, but you're not necessarily having to reflect on your clinical practice. When you're doing a self-study, you're learning what the research says. You're maybe even learning how to apply it, but nobody's holding you accountable to anything there. Nobody's holding you accountable to study by certain periods or doing knowledge checks. And so, I mean, I don't know the exact numbers for the pass rate of residency versus residency folks who take the OCS versus folks who do the self-study, but I know that it's substantially lower for the folks who self-study, which becomes a problem. We've seen periodically for those who go through fellowship and haven't already gotten their OCS and then decide to do the self-study and then fail their OCS, and then it prohibits them from graduating their fellowship program, which becomes problematic also. But I would just say that, you know, by far to me, when I was going through, now I didn't have, and hopefully my OCS mentor isn't going to listen to this, but if they do, I didn't have fantastic, phenomenal mentoring throughout my OCS, but I had outstanding mentoring through my fellowship. And so I really set the bar and set the quality example of what really good clinical mentorship should look like. And then, you know, hopefully whoever your clinical mentor is on that side, you know, of residency or fellowship, tries to take those principles that make a really good experience of mentorship and drive that into your residency or fellowship program. So that guided learning and then the guided mentoring for me was what really set that apart from a self-study model.
Yeah, and that being said, just for the listeners, the definition for residency, according to AOMPT, is a planned program of post-professional clinical and didactic education for physical therapists that is designed to advance significantly the physical therapist's preparation as a provider of patient care services in a defined area of clinical practice. Now, when we go to fellowship, it's a post-professional funded and planned learning experience in a focused area of clinical practice, education, or research. Not infrequently postdoctoral or for post-residency prepared or board certified therapist. Now, I don't know who else out there, but I've been through both residency and fellowship and also taught in both. And the lines get a little bit blurry and it gets a little bit fuzzy aside from the things that you need prior to actually enrolling. So there are a ton of programs out there, and it does get a little bit fuzzy around the edges when we're talking about these things, but that is what we have historically defined the two as. And they go on to suggest, you know, a little synopsis of what is the true difference between a residency and fellowship. And you're welcome to read that. It's referenced also on APTA's website under education section for clinical residency and fellowship credentialing. So you've got a ton of programs out there. And mind you, when it says it's funded, some places fund, some do not fund. So it is funded, but it might be by you 100% or 0%, depending on what route you go. That being said, Josh, when you're talking to residents, I think that you've probably experienced a bunch of frustration with residents. What are those typical frustrations in residency? And then we'll circle back and we'll get to that mentorship side, because that's definitely an entry-level buzzword. And really, quite honestly, even a new graduate buzzword looking for mentorship. But for now, let's stick to the vents of the residents. What do you hear on the street? What's on the street in the residency?
So are you asking for mine as the mentor's vents? Yeah. Okay. So for me, what's frustrating, and you get it periodically, but you get the residents who go through it for the wrong reason, right? They go through it for the credentials, and then they complain about how much work they have to put in. And then reality is that residency is as much work as you put into it. You know, you can get very little out of it by putting very little into it, or you can get a ton out of it by putting a ton into it. And my best residents asked me questions. They came prepared every mentor session. They reached out to me between mentor sessions to go over patient cases. And the ones who were really much more challenging, also, by the way, the ones who failed their OCS exam were the ones who didn't keep up on top of assignments. They had program directors breathing down my neck to make sure that they got stuff done on time. And I'm just thinking, you're an adult with a doctoral degree going through a postdoctoral program. I shouldn't need to babysit you. And so for me, the big thing as a mentor was, you know, having residents who are self-motivated and driven to make sure that they got something out of that. Now, I can sit there and I can talk at somebody. I'm really good at talking at people for long periods of time. I'm really good at it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know this, but you know, the reality is it works so much better if there's a dialogue instead of a monologue. And so the residents who brought the dialogue and really they started the conversation and they knew what they wanted to get out of it. Those were the folks who, you know, were really fun to work with and really easy to work with. And the ones who just were resistant to, whether it was they didn't want to change their clinical practice because they already thought that they knew a whole bunch, or they didn't want to change their clinical practice because it was too much work to not do a bunch of modalities and have three patients going and already know their exercise routine because they've done it for the last 20 visits, and then say, well, what can I do with this patient? And then you give them feedback and advice, and they're like, okay. And then, you know, a couple visits later, they're still doing the same thing.
Yeah, it's not 10 calf raises.
Right. It's like, come on, guys. You know, we don't need to do 3x10 of everything. And if, you know, if you're on visit 30 and you're still working on the table exclusively, you've done something massively wrong, right? And so those are the people who, the ones who just refused to have a little introspection and do any sort of self-reflection. And those who, you know, look, I'm not a PT guru or a god by any means. But I've certainly been through more than a lot of these folks have. And so I've got some decent ideas, and not all of my ideas are right. And a lot of the time they're wrong, but that's the fun of doing this stuff, is that we can learn from each other. And, but that doesn't happen if, you know, it's a one-sided monologue coming from me talking to somebody who doesn't really try. And then again, they're not studying. And then ultimately they're in it for the three letters after their name, and then they're not passing their test. So they're not getting those letters anyway. So essentially they just wasted, you know, time, money, and effort, or very little effort to do something that is of no benefit to them.
Yeah. So you raise up some points there with mentorship as well, just being a little proactive and planning and things like that. And some people, I would say the naysayers out there that are listening to this, that say, I'm a great clinician and I didn't do any of those things. And I feel like I'm a great mentor and I add a lot to the APTA. And we would probably say, you're probably right. You do all of those things. But what makes it so challenging for somebody straight out of entry-level program to find a fit or a clinical mentor that isn't necessarily as structured as a residency? So we know a bunch of corporations, hospitals, entities in general are pitching because they know that mentorship is a huge buzzword. We know it's even more important with burnout and everything else on the rise. But what do you say to those naysayers who say, you can just find a structure within any place. You can negotiate that. What do you see the problems with that or opportunities as well on the flip side?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things too, where, sometimes having not great mentorship can be a good thing. You know, if you're a driven individual, and I don't mean that it would be better than having great mentorship, it wouldn't, but it can set a standard for what you don't want to be, right? I mean, it can drive, hey, I know that this is the opposite of what I want to be. I didn't see any benefit or any value in this. And because it is, like you said, it's a huge buzzword right now in new grad mentorship and residency and fellowship mentorship. And there's a lot of people out there. There's a lot of great mentors out there. But then there are a lot of people out there who just phone it in and they use that mentorship time as time where they can work on other stuff or, you know, sit on Instagram and scroll through Facebook while somebody else either treats their patients or while they travel to their mentee's clinic and just pretend to watch their mentee practice. It's really frustrating in a lot of ways because you see that happen. And not that all of those folks are bad mentors. They're just maybe not consistent with a lot of that. And so, the advice that I would have for new grads or for people that are really trying to enhance their clinical skills, whether it be just through some sort of structured mentorship outside of residency or a residency or fellowship mentorship, is that, you have to kind of try to do your research on people to the best of your ability. And I don't want to say that you call them up and you interview them and you get their thoughts on life and spirituality and everything else and under the sun, but maybe have a discussion with some people who have worked with them in the past, talk to people who have gone through that particular residency program or other folks who work there and even people who don't have ties to that residency program, right? I mean, I talk to people all the time about residency or fellowship program perceptions of other programs and say, I don't know anything about, X, Y, and Z program. Have you heard anything or do you know anything about that? And they haven't gone through the program either, but people have heard things through the grapevine. And so it gives you that opportunity to hear some, good things, bad things about the program and maybe some mentorship. And you start to meet people that come out of certain programs. And so as you go down these rabbit holes, you network really well. And then you start to get more and more information on all these things. But I really think that it's one of those things that you do have to, whether it's, say, a hospital-based outpatient ortho residency, or a big private residency program, you really have to do your research on the program, the content of the program, understand what the curriculum is, understand what their goals for their residents are. Some programs are, really focused on patient outcomes. Some programs are going to be more focused just on the fact that you're credentialed differently so you can market it so that you can see more patients. You also want to know what a residency program's intent of you graduating and what their plan is for their residents or if they even have one after you graduate. So all of those things I think are really important to understand before you sign your soul away on that dotted line of a residency, fellowship, whatever contract.
Yeah, I would say that's fair. You hit high points just with suggestion of one, they need to network really well because you don't know what you don't know. And until you're around those people and they describe the situations and how their clinical skill set was really fostered through a specific setup, they don't know that it exists. And that's true. Yeah. So I think that getting to professional events or just looking on LinkedIn to see who are the, you know, who's the superhero, maybe it's podcasts, who knows, because expertise does, it does evolve and it has changed a little bit with how people find those individuals. That being said, go ahead.
No, I was just agreeing. I mean, it really has, I'm not a big social media guy, but, the amount of information that's out there from, top tier researchers on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, I'm not talking about like these meme pages on Instagram or anything, and not that they can't have good content, or even relay some good information, but we're talking the big name researchers who understand all this stuff, who've been around for years and years and years. All of that stuff is so readily available, and we've moved away from what was really the golden age of PT in terms of reimbursement, where it's like you just slap a hot pack on somebody, you do a little rubby on somebody's back, and you maybe put them on a bike and give them an exercise or two, and you call it a day, and you get paid a zillion dollars for it. And now we're in this kind of crisis that we're in now from a financial standpoint as a profession. With all this information out there, it gives us this opportunity to really drive away from that stuff and show our value.
Yeah. And I think that raises a really interesting point. Like, number one, I'll give a horror story just real quick so you know where I'm coming from. But after residency and after fellowship training, so it doesn't matter whether it's formal training through that or you've been out for 10 years and you're trying to describe the difference between you and your approach to maybe another physical therapist or something like that. But I remember I sat down at a Panera Bread company and was having a breakfast with a physician. And I started going through like, hey, we follow the medical model. We have this thing called residency fellowship. This is how long it takes. This is what you get. This is how it challenges you. There's some formal tests and checkpoints and formal mentorship, all of these components that make it really, really important and valuable as a clinician. The rebuttal to that from the physician was, well, does that mean you stretch a hamstring differently than the physical therapist down the road? And I didn't really have an answer. So it really made me upset. Number one, I was kind of beside myself. And I remember just complete meltdown in my brain. I thought that anybody who thinks that small isn't worth my explanation or time anyway.
Absolutely.
But you can also guarantee that they're not the only person thinking that. And that includes, because I've had conversations with physical therapists that believe the same thing. And hopefully we can kind of paint a picture of why that's not necessarily the case, but it does have its dark sides as far as cost and some of these other things that we're already strapped with. I mean, we talk about entry-level programs, most students are coming out with over $100,000 debt. Residencies, I don't know. Josh, do you know the average price of a residency these days?
It's probably somewhere between 12 to 15,000.
And then equal price depending on the length of the fellowship. And then if you wanted to do something beyond that, probably double, triple that again, at least at some sort of premium there. So it's hard to, I think, from just a financial perspective, to really encourage somebody who's telling you, hey, I've got $148,000 in debt because I went to a private school in New York. And should I still, I think that I relate to residency and what it does and ultimately what APTA likes about it. And I also want to do fellowship, and that's a vehicle to get there. Is it worth another $30,000 to do that? I admire what you've done, Josh. Should I do it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really great question. And I think we're again, and we had this conversation in our DSC synchronous meeting a couple months ago. We're really, as a professional, we're at kind of this crossroads of where do we want to go? because you know the doctoral level profession is great. You know, we need to be autonomous practitioners. We need that direct access, and that's, you know, that's really non-negotiable at this point. But the cost of higher ed in general, not just physical therapy programs, but higher ed in general is, you know, astronomical. And I was reading today that I think it was over like the last decade, PT school, just entry-level DPT costs have outpaced wages, PT wages, by 2.5 to 3 times. And so when you're looking at people who, you know, I won't throw out any universities, but there was one out in the general area of my old stomping grounds in North Carolina, that a lot of those students are graduating with almost $250,000 in debt, right? And I think that a lot of these students come out and they're like, well, I'm going to have a doctoral degree, so I'm going to make $100,000+ a year right out of the gate. And the reality is that's not at all realistic, right? I mean, if you go and you work at a place that pays you really well out of school in outpatient orthopedics, at least, you might be looking at 70 to 75 at best, right? So now you've got 3+ times your annual salary in student loan debt. I mean, it really is dependent on what you want to do after that point. Now, I was very fortunate. I graduated still from a private school and, you know, from a private institution. But I had 6 years instead of 7 years. We did a 3+3 program and was able to get out of there with one less year than everyone else had, which
by the way, are coming back around. There were just some issues, but
right. Which is fantastic. You know, I think again, you know, depending on the model, it can certainly work. But you know, I look at the cost, you know, and where I was, and luckily my lovely wife, who is finishing a neuro residency right now, when we graduated PT school, she had no debt. So, which was great. So it allowed us to actually be a little bit more financially free than if we had both had, you know, $100,000+ in PT school debt. And then it allowed, you know, our financial flexibility, and then her being supportive, allowed me to do residency and fellowship, and ultimately now this Dr. Science program. But that's not everyone's reality. And despite the fact that, you know, yeah, maybe after you graduate fellowship, some institutions will give you a little bit of a pay bump. Julie Whitman and a couple of our cohort, DSC cohort mates, Brett Nielsen and Mark Shepard, just published a study that was looking at, you know, their perception, their fellow graduates' perception of whether or not the program was worth it. And they did. They reported about a $10,000 increase in annual pay. But you also have to consider, you went through residency, you went through fellowship, you put time, effort, money into all of this stuff. And, you know, you possibly added $20,000-$30,000 in debt. And now you add $10,000 a year, but not everybody wants to go the fellowship route. Not everybody wants to change kind of career paths either. And I know a lot of people who have, you know, either taken pay cuts because they got through fellowship and realized, you know, they were working at a huge institution or a huge company that was more focused on patient volume and profits than quality of care. And so they took less money to go be, you know, provide the quality of care that they went to fellowship training for. And so I think it's just this really interesting dynamic right now. And the reality of residency is that even if you go through residency and you pass your OCS, most places aren't going to reward you for doing that. You know, you have to ultimately probably leave your job and find another job somewhere else in order to see any sort of financial benefit from resident. Not to say that you can't do that or that would be wrong. But I think that's the reality that people also need to consider, is that, you know, if you love where you work and you don't want to change jobs, they're not going to pay you in all likelihood, unless you have something in writing that's agreed upon beforehand that is the case. In which case, great, good for you. But that's not the reality in my experience in the vast majority of cases.
Right. And I think to speak on that, just going back to some of the really positive things about additional training, whether that's residency or fellowship, is I've heard across the country, different organizations say, hey, we only want to hire somebody if they are a clinical specialist in whatever the field is, or that they meet this other criterion list, which could be years experience or something like that. And so I also believe, and I don't, because I'm definitely am not up to speed on the entire country's legislation, but I believe that provisions have been set forth either for clinical specialists or residency or fellowship training as it relates to direct access in maybe Texas. And I know there's some conversation about doing things like that in the future with some other things that the profession's planning on. So I do think that that's important. And I also think it's nice that you brought up, you need to recognize the system that you're currently in or your potential beyond whatever the training is that you're looking at, because it's whatever the market will bear, and or if there's, you know, demand for it with whatever group or organization you're currently working for. But, you know, I'd be curious, did that study make a suggestion to how quickly was it immediately after graduation salary and expected earnings increased by that sum? Or was it within 3 years, did it say?
If I remember, it was within like 5 years. I think it was conducted within a 5 to 10 year period, or like within their last 5 to 10 years of graduates. So right. it was really that 10,000 increase in annual salary was really the average of everyone. So I don't know a timeline on that. They didn't report one that I remember seeing.
And I would say that that's definitely true in the cohorts that I've witnessed just within our own organizations. And I would say, but you definitely have the cases where they're still doing something and getting paid a certain amount for what their previous skill set used to be. And that's nobody's fault in general. I mean, they could be very, very happy with that. And I think physical therapists in general would be really happy with people, what we sometimes call practicing at the apex of their licensure, which is, or as close to apex as they could get, which is as much training and doing really good physical therapy and then not abandon ship. I not too long ago heard a physical therapist quit doing physical therapy as a clinic leader and opened up a ice cream truck. So, and then you're hearing all sorts of stuff out there. It's really disheartening, but you got to find a way to make your skills, whatever the market would pay, get that. And that comes back to PTs have trouble negotiating this stuff. So I'm glad you brought that up.
A little too nice at times. And you know, that's great. You know, we're caring and we're compassionate and we're kind, and that's wonderful. But you do, at some point you kind of have to look out for yourself. And part of our issue now, I think, you know, when you bring up the ice cream truck, is that, you know, you're seeing tons of people burn out, and you know, the burnout rates within PT are just astronomical and I think in large part, you know, we go back to the debt to income discussion, but then the workload that you're having. So, I mean, you're doing a ton of work in a lot of with a lot of these companies, and, you know, their way of thanking you is to say, you know, shoot out an email and say, hey, great job on so-and-so for seeing 9,000 visits this week. It's like, well, I would have much rather seen like 45 visits this week, gotten paid a little bit less even. Or if I was going to see this massive amount, like start paying me more, right? It's not a direct correlation and proportion of here's how hard I worked and so here's how I got paid. It's not that, unfortunately. And so I think we're seeing just, you know, astronomical rates of burnout, which is leading to somebody leaving the PT profession and going to start an ice cream truck. And who, hey, look, I love ice cream, man. I eat it all the time. So maybe I'll have to find who that person is and I'll visit their new business.
Yeah. And, you know, it could have been for other reasons. Obviously, we would hope that there's reasons behind that. But I do think you bring up, you know, burnout, and we talk about just the normal, and we're talking specifically about outpatient, but this is more widespread than that. We're talking about skilled nursing. Pretty much every setting has their flaws that contribute to burnout. But what if I said residency and fellowship contribute to that? The demands in the program contribute to that. Do you think that it contributes, or does it actually renew the physical therapist or some combination?
Yes. That's my short answer. I would say that absolutely it contributes, particularly probably really in that intermediate to end term of the program. You know, you're in the beginning, you're all gung ho, you're ready to learn new stuff, and then you're ready to apply that stuff immediately. And it's exciting, it's fun. You know, you're meeting new people, you're networking with your cohort, with your instructors, all that good stuff. And then, you know, you hit the midway point and you're like, God dang, man, am I ever going to be done with this stuff? And then you hit the end and you're just like, I am ready to be done and I'm never looking back and I'm never doing anything like this ever again, until somebody like you or I goes and decides, okay, let's do something else. Let's do the next.
Then you sign up for something else, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. There's always something else. But you know, and I think that in that respect, it does kind of renew it, and then it probably fades into a little bit more of the burnout. And then once you're done, I think it kind of renews it again, because now you can use all the stuff that you've learned. And oh, by the way, you don't have to spend 10 to 20 hours a week of doing posts and following up on discussions and doing assignments and all those things. So then all of a sudden you feel so much more free than you did before. And so I think there are so many components that play into burnout, that I think that residency fellowship programs do a really good job of giving you other opportunities too. You know, not only are you, by the time that you've gone through your program, you've probably not been burnt out, then been burnt out, and then renewed from the burnout. But then, you know, say from fellowship, now you have teaching opportunities within residency programs. Now you have more so than residency will give you more opportunities to help out with entry-level DPT programs, whether it's as an adjunct professor or getting a full-time faculty appointment. But it just, they open avenues, and whether it's the networking, whether it's the skill set, whatever you want to say is that piece that really does it. I think that certainly helps to prevent burnout, rather than if you just go out and you take a couple con ed courses to meet the bare minimum requirements for your state of licensure every reporting period. And then you never follow up with any clinical mentorships, or your clinical practice never changes, so you do the same thing every day. That I think, you know, is where residency and fellowship really set themselves apart in terms of trying to prevent burnout. But it's really up to the individual kind of what they want to do with it after they're done to help prevent that burnout.
I think you're right on that. Definitely. Sorry to interrupt, but I think that a lot of it's on the individual, but I don't want to push it all on them, because I think a lot is also on the organization.
Yes.
And I think just to interject just real quick, like if you look at, I mean, do not be fooled. The individual has a huge, they control their schedule for the most part, is what goes on after hours and how they regenerate themselves. And there's a book I like called Fully Charged. Like, that helped me figure out a lot of stuff during residency. But industrial and organizational psychologists would also say that if the organization is not set up for a microculture of advanced clinicians or advanced clinical training, so peers that can empathize and give them, you know, compassionate guidance on what they're doing. And also we're talking about a minority of the clinicians in most cultures are, you know, going through something like this. And so having something set up to where they can, you don't want to say commiserate, but where they can lean on each other. And like you said, kind of talk to each other about it and vent and have those avenues, but also really get inspired by what other people are doing around them. And I think you need, from top to bottom, you know, a leader, a president, vice president of whatever that is, and really, really strong policy procedures or systems in place for retaining that talent, that clinical talent. Otherwise, I think what you find is that they leave and do something else, like sell ice cream or.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you want those folks to stay around after they've gone through that, because they do, they bring that. And that's what happened for me through residency. Is I got into, when I was in PT school, I said, I don't want to do residency. I just want to get out. I want to treat patients. I want to be good at my job. I want to go home. you know, I want to love my life, love my wife, have a wonderful time, all that good stuff. And then once I graduated, I'm like, well, I don't know anything. And so then I went through residency and I said the same thing. I was like, this is it. I'm done. But you start to see all those people at the next level, and you know, it's motivating and it's inspiring. And those are the people that you want to be around. You want to be those people. You want to talk to those people. You want to be around them so that you can continue to learn, because you just realize that there's so many, especially in our profession. I mean, you know, our profession really is not, it's a science, but it's an art form. It's not a black and white, if this, then this. It's not this clear cut algorithm. Every single patient is going to respond differently. And so trying to figure out the best ways to manage that, and residency and fellowship programs give you that, you know, kind of that construct within which to work and make decisions and alter your practice to meet the needs of your patients. Whereas, not to say that you can't necessarily have that, but I do think it's more difficult if you haven't had some of that exposure at the very least to those folks. You know, maybe you work in a clinic where you're around a bunch of really fantastic OCS, FAMPT folks, and you're seeing that on a daily basis. And so that itself is, you know, that internal and external motivation. But if you're in a single therapist clinic and you don't have, and you've never seen that, and you don't have exposure to that, and you're not going through one of those programs, where's your motivation to get better? And you know, if you're one of those individuals who doesn't necessarily have a strong internal drive, then that's going to be really challenging. And I think that's going to lead to more and more burnout, because you're just doing the same stuff all the time, and you're not seeing things that are motivating and that incite, you know, passion about the profession from you.
Yeah, I feel that. I think we spoke a lot about the high points on residency and touched definitely on fellowship or just post-professional training in general. Josh, is there anything else that you feel like you want to stand on a soapbox real quick and talk about, just as far as continuing education, post-professional training, you know, some misconceptions, or do you want to demystify anything for anybody?
So this is kind of my soapbox. I saw on LinkedIn a couple weeks ago, and I took a screenshot of it and I sent it to my wife, and I felt a little self-righteous while saying it, but I really feel this way. You know, I've been around some really fantastic clinicians and some really amazing educators, and you know, they all say the same thing. You know, I am learning. I am not an expert. I've just studied this stuff extensively. I'm open to new ideas. I'm open to new theories. I'm open to trying new things. And I saw somebody post, I don't even know who she was. You need to see these things from random people you've never met or aren't even connected with on LinkedIn. And it said, you know, I just finished X specialty certification, passed my board exam. And so, you know, this is my new specialty. And you know, so now I have this specialty and this specialty. So that means I am an expert in two areas of, you know, these, this and this of physical therapy. And I took the picture and I sent it to my wife and I said, I don't mean to be condescending, because that's not where I'm coming from. But to call yourself an expert in a field like ours just seems a little disingenuous. I don't know that we certainly have the people who are far more knowledgeable. But to say, you know, that becoming an OCS clinician, which you can do, what, a year, year and a half out of school and have your OCS, doesn't make you an expert. You know, I'd still take somebody who's 10, 15 years sometimes out of, not in all cases, but who doesn't have any post-professional training, and I'd rather them treat me or my family. So that doesn't make you an expert. I think what makes you the quote unquote expert is more of your thought process and how you approach residency, fellowship, continuing ed courses, you know, staying on top of current research, being willing to alter your own clinical practice. If you're out there and you're, you know, doing ultrasound on people's low backs for 100% of people that come in with, you know, acute or chronic low back pain, and you see all this research that says, hey, you know, manipulation and, you know, manual therapy and load progression and all these things, and you're like, yeah, you know, I'm an expert. I know what I'm saying. You know, like, that's not the expert mindset. The expert mindset is really to roll with those punches and to modify your clinical practice as is appropriate. And not to say that research is everything, because if, when you look at those three pillars of evidence, certainly clinical practice experience falls into that as well. But being able to really encompass all of those things and being able to be flexible and really never stop learning. And that's what I think a lot of people tend to do after PT school, is once they go out there, and that was another study that was done. I can't remember what study that was. But there was a study that was looking at, you know, Con Ed, whether Con Ed with mentoring or Con Ed without mentoring was beneficial. And what they found was that just going and taking a continuing education class and then not having any further follow-up didn't change clinical outcomes. But taking that same Con Ed course and then following up with, you know, a couple sessions, not even like, you know, months and months of mentoring, but just a couple sessions of mentoring to basically keep people honest, made significant changes in clinical metrics. So, you know, it's really about keeping yourself accountable to not falling back into those ruts repetitively, which is so easy to do, especially in our profession where it gets so busy and bogged down in certain things so often. So yeah, that's what I would say. You know, you're not the, no one's there. There are no clinical experts out there. I think there are just those of us who know a little bit more and those of us who know a little bit less, and all of us should be trying to learn more every single day to better help our patients and to further progress our profession.
So I'll ask you this last, I guess, kind of question as far as the societal view on this, or maybe corporate view, or just anybody who's thinking at it from a business end. I appreciate that you did that, and I'm glad that you're driving for what nobody ever achieves, which is mastery or clinical excellence. You're looking for that. But I don't want to pay you anymore. I'm not going to pay you anymore. Your license makes me the same net rate as Bob's or Cindy's over there. And, you know, they are 1 year or 6 months removed from school. Why do I pay you more?
All right. Well, now you're just trying to start fights about reimbursement and payment models and all that stuff. And I really don't appreciate that. But to give you kind of my best, probably most appropriate response to that is I think, you know, when you have that, you're really looking at clinical effectiveness and efficiency. And, you know, there was another study that looked at employers' perceptions of folks who were residency and fellowship trained. And the interesting thing about it was that they actually had more negative things to say about people who graduated from fellowship programs, because, and the negative things were essentially, you know, they felt like people were looking down on folks who didn't have that that training. And but I think that the perception out there from employers is by and large positive on post-professional training. Like you said, I don't know that all of them are going to be willing to pay a substantial amount more. The argument that I would make in favor of paying someone more is, look, you know, I'm going to get people better faster. I'm going to be able to give higher quality care. So I'm going to not only treat my patient, but then they're going to bring in their family members. They're going to tell their friends. And now all of a sudden you've taken your referral base, which was one patient from one physician, and now you've got five or six of their friends and family coming to see you over the course of a year. And so you can really market yourself that way, because patients don't care. I mean, the number of patients who cared that I was going through fellowship, they all said, oh, cool. You know, that's great that you're going through that program. They didn't care. They didn't, you know, a lot of times, especially before I got my credentials, it wasn't like they've ever requested me because of my credentials. They requested me because they knew someone that had a great experience, or their physician highly recommended they come to see me. And so those components and part of that employer perception too, and the research that they've done, is that the soft skills that you learn, that you pick up in residency and fellowship, your ability to communicate and establish effective rapport and just manage people, and especially in difficult situations, is better in residency and fellowship trained clinicians. And so, you know, your ability to have better patient retention and then bring more patients in from that without even having to go and market to physicians, with our continued improvements and hopefully continuing improvements in direct access, that's really, I think, where you're going to see fellowship and residency trained clinicians separate themselves from other folks, especially folks who are early in their careers. You know, somebody who's got 20 years experience might have already improved upon that, but the folks early on who might have a little bit more of that imposter syndrome or really struggle a lot with some of those soft skills might improve that substantially with residency and fellowship training. And then that's going to allow you to retain patients and build that patient caseload and ultimately make your company more money, or have a more reliable source of revenue, as opposed to, you know, new grads who come in and yeah, they might see a high volume, but their patient turnover is, you know, like this. And then they're wondering why can't they see their patients? You know, why won't their patients continue to come and see them? And why are they seeing 100 evals every week while everyone else is only able to see two or three? You know, that's your rationale as to why, hey, I can get you more money. I can get you more reliable source of patients coming in so that it's not up and down and so dependent on physician or outside referrals.
Yeah, I think being able, you hit a number of good things there, but one of them is just because you achieve something that gives you a credential or, you know, textbook credibility doesn't necessarily mean that it's worth something to somebody, an employer per se. You need to figure out what skills within the training that you did go through in the formal credentials or credibility there makes you more valuable to the person that you're seeking employment. And if you can connect those things because they have systems in place where that is valuable, that's all you're trying to leverage at that point. And I think that that's an important distinction, is just because you do get board certification in geriatric, clinical specialties or wound care specialty, something like that, does not immediately make you worth more. It's being able to leverage the skill set that every day that you learn during that time to make yourself more valuable to that. So definitely had fun talking about that stuff. I always finish with just a couple of the questions that were recommended just from a mutual friend of ours. So if you're ready, I'm going to go ahead and give you some of those.
Let's do it.
So what are you currently most excited or passionate about right now, aside from the DSCPT?
Yeah, well, that's number one, because we've got the comprehensive written and oral finals coming up. So that's number one on the books right now. Professionally, I would say that my opportunity at Midwestern University in Arizona is what I'm really most fired up right now about. We start the fall quarter here in about a month. And so I'll be teaching PT eval and helping with kinesiology class. And hopefully one of these days I'll be able to get licensed again. So I'll be working with students in the clinic. And it's so much fun to be able to be in the clinic with students and watch them grow. And so I would say that's really professionally where I'm most fired up to be right now.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. I would say that's pretty exciting stuff. A whole lot going on amidst COVID-19 as well. Yeah. So next question would be, what's the most influential thing or experience for you really in the past year?
Oh boy. The most influential is probably losing all of my jobs due to COVID-19, so that I then had an opportunity to take this new one. But I think really the real answer to that question was getting an opportunity about a year ago to start working at High Point University. And it was just as an assisting role. I mean, I would show up to lab and I would help, you know, assist with labs and teaching students skills and all that stuff. And I knew that I enjoyed that, but I didn't know how much. and that opportunity to be involved in that and to help assist with a couple lectures and kind of moving into an adjunct role with them has been really, really influential, I would say, in my progression professionally at this point.
And then lastly, what's been your biggest failure or learning experience?
Oh God, there are so many. I would say, you know, biggest failure, I have to go back to fellowship and going through
choosing fellowship, right?
What's that?
Choosing fellowship. No.
Yeah. Right. Deciding to do it ever. No, it was so great. And I think the thing that I valued the most was that was really where, I mean, I've never really been one who's been very good with failure. And I learned that you have to, I mean, you don't have a choice. You're going to fail stuff or you're going to fail at something if you don't fail a video case. And I think those video cases where I didn't fail a video case, but boy, I got chewed a few new holes on that one. It was really, you know, it's like, oh, you didn't do that and you didn't do that and you didn't do that. And you walk away from those video cases and you feel pretty awful about yourself. And then, you know, a couple of days go by and you reflect and you rewatch the video and you're like, did I really do all those things? Cause you've now watched like four times and you're like, oh, I really do all those things.
Yep.
And so while it's a huge failure, you feel like a huge failure, it's an amazing learning opportunity. And I just sat in on a fellowship case this week where, you know, we've had a couple cases that have been a little bit challenging. And I know they walk away with that feeling of boy, that was really rough. It's like, yeah, it wasn't perfect. Nobody's done a perfect case that I've seen to this point, a perfect evaluation, but you know, learning from, because every patient you're going to fail, at least in some regard, right? You don't do everything perfectly. So learning how to recover from those and not make that same mistake again are really important skill sets to have as a healthcare provider and as a PT. And so I'd say that's my biggest failure.
I'm sure you have a bunch of fans out there that can empathize with that. But we appreciate that, Josh. And just for all of those listeners out there, what is the best way to get a hold of you or get in contact with you to maybe comment on some of the things that they love that you had to say or follow up with anything that you talked about on this show?
Let me look at and see something real quick because I have no idea what my little Instagram handle is, but it's something. But if somebody wants to, if anyone wants to email me, they can email me at my Midwestern University email, which is jsubia@midwestern.edu. Anyone's always more than willing, or if they're willing to text me or they want to text me, their texts or calls are also always welcome. My phone number is 763-228-6370. And they can probably find me somewhere on Instagram. Oh yeah, there it is. JSubialka @JSUBIALKA. Go ahead and follow. I don't post anything really, but if anybody wants to message me or have a scintillating, you know, a scintillating conversation on Instagram, by all means, go right ahead. I follow some PT folks on Instagram, so I'm on Twitter too. But I do that once every year when I go to AOMP, then I hop on Twitter again, and then I hop back off the next week, and I'm never on it until the next year. So.
Well, we appreciate that. And what we'll do, we'll post that for those of you that missed it. We will put it on the show notes and we'll look forward to hosting you again, Josh.
Yeah, Ryan, thanks so much for the time. I had a blast.
All right, thanks. And that's all for this episode of Spilling the DPT. We'll look forward to spilling with y'all next time. And if you don't mind, in the meantime, drop us a rating and a comment. And we'll look forward to you tuning in next time.